we open things up by asking about morality, what reasons there were why some things were right and other things were wrong. As we look at them, you know, why should I do this or why shouldn't I do that? And it was somewhere during the discussion suggested that there might be three ways to look at the problem of morality. One is that God, sort of arbitrarily, because he was all-powerful, looked down at human beings and decided there were certain things he didn't want them doing, and that's all there was to it. Thou shalt not, and our discussion yesterday seemed, and I think for very good reason, and I'm going to talk about this reason today, seemed to center on sex more than anything else. God said, thou shalt not commit adultery, and this can be interpreted to mean don't have any fun, and Paul mentioned that St. Augustine's point of view, that you should try not to have pleasure out of sex, even if you're married, that somehow there's something forbidden about this area of life. The second suggestion was that either the economic, the social, or the political necessity of keeping a community moving dictated certain laws, that if you commit adultery, you see you're interfering with family relationships, or if you steal, you're upsetting the community. You know, it's bad for the community, either economically, politically, or socially. And a third possibility suggested was that for the individual happiness or well-being or mental health of an individual person, there are certain things that have been found out either on purpose or by accident, but psychologically, if you do these things, you are harmed individually, and if you don't do certain other things, you're also harmed. And this is sort of the basis of I suppose, the first 10 commandments, and then later on, laws that have been put into being by legislative bodies since the 10 commandments. Now, is there anyone that wants to add to the summary of what we did yesterday? This is sort of where I plan to continue the discussion today. Anybody want first to mention something that I left out in this summary? Did we do more than that? This is what I really plan to start from this morning. Anybody? I want to make, at first, my own personal point of view, which in a way incorporates these three answers, but especially leans towards individual psychology. And in order to do this, I want to take a few minutes to mention what I believe to be the psychological nature of each individual human being. I've talked before to different groups here in book discussion and whatnot that most psychologists agree, at least developmental psychologists, that when man is born, and this is different from when he's conceived, and we went into some length about this in one of these discussions, that when man is conceived, he may be in the, you know, a form of good, which may be called the image and likeness of God, but when he's born, and because of the frustration of the birth process, he's very narcissistic or egocentric or very much in love with himself. Now, one psychologist who started the ball rolling really here was Sigmund Freud, and I think that even though he said a lot of wrong things, he had a real deep insight into the nature of man in many ways. But what he said is that man's most selfish nature is really determined on what he called a sexual realm. And for sex, he meant anything that was sensual or erotic. And Freud said when a man is born, he has various zones of the body that are very erotic, and we talked before about the myth of Pinocchio in this connection. I want to talk about a different one now. Freud said that man's selfish nature as an infant and as a young human being is very typified by this story of Aladdin and his magic lamp. This is a sexual story, but it's an autoerotic sexuality, the homosexual type of activity. See, what Freud means by homosexual is, I'm the center of the universe and relationships aren't important, but my own thrills, my own sensuality, that's all that counts. That I have first my mouth needs met, that I'm able to suck a lot and I stimulate my lips. And we know that when babies are born, this is the most sensitive part of their body and their activity is pretty much mouth-directed. And Freud called this the oral stage. And later on, and Freud isn't very clear about why, except for social reasons in potty training, you know, when the neighbors start saying, is Johnny still filling his pants, and things like this, the mother starts really potty training, that the central part of the body moves down to the region of the body involved in potty training, and then in what he calls the phallic stage, about age 3 and a half, it begins and lasts, essentially in history, until about age 6, but in some senses continues in most human beings throughout the rest of their life. According to Freud's theory, what happens is the human being's most selfish part of his existence, his most autoerotic zone of his body is the genital area, but in a way that is not involving a relationship with another human being, one where the entire satisfaction and the entire self-direction is viewed for personal sensual satisfaction. And this is the story of Aladdin and his magic lamp, where the myth goes like this, that Aladdin goes into a very dark secret place. It's a cave, but it's hidden from public view. It's not exposed. And in this secret place, this unexposed place from human view, he discovers a lamp. Well, this lamp is in a very special shape, and this is pointed out by the Cyclades people what the shape of these really lamps are. And when he strokes this lamp, and he only has to stroke it three times, but after tactile stimulation of this secret treasure in this unexposed hidden place, all of a sudden a genie, and it's sort of funny, the word here genie, how the letters G-E-N-I are also the first four letters of the word genital, that there seems to be a very close connection, but no, really, both in the meaning of this word genie and its issuing from this lamp, and also I won't take too much time in going into that, but what Freud is really suggesting here is this is the way human beings are in their infancy, very selfish, that they get their most pleasure, their most wishes are satisfied by stroking of this magic lamp and having this genie put them in a world of fantasy where all of their desires are met. This is an extremely selfish point of view. It's Aladdin's story, or Freud's, what he calls the phallic stage. People in this stage are not ever concerned with a love relationship, but only with a narcissistic self-love. Let my satisfactions be met, and the most intense satisfaction I can find is that of sexual activity, auto-erotic sexual activity. Now, it's my point of view, and this is why we're talking about sex and these things. My point of view that people not only are born this selfish and self-centered and take their own pleasure above and beyond anything else of other people, but that the majority of people in this world, and I would guess over 90% of them, remain fixated pretty much at this level. They never really develop, and even in Freud's theory, Freud's point of view is that for people to be happy, they have to progress from the phallic stage to what he calls the genital stage, where they're no longer so concerned about their own pleasure as they are in a relationship, a heterosexual relationship, he says, and one that involves intercourse. But Freud even says for a human being to be happy, he has to give up his narcissism, his self-love, and relate to another human being on this intimate level. Now, my point of view is that most people never quite reach this, that most people in all of their relationships are still mostly narcissistic and selfish. They have themselves mostly in their minds. I want my pleasure and my satisfaction above and beyond what needs I'm meeting in other people. This is what I'm doing now is trying to relate this to theology and point out why I think laws have been established either by God or by man. Because man is born this way and stays this way naturally, and this is my belief, man is naturally theologically in the state of original sin. He is selfish for in all of his life, and he has no power within himself ever to change. No power within himself. The only way a person ever can change from this self-centeredness into what Freud would call a relationship, or there are other personality theorists that I much prefer to quote than Freud, Eric Erickson, for instance, who has 8 stages of personality development, and I think personally has a lot to say, that if a person is ever going to go from self-centeredness into a relationship, he must first experience love. He must have other people see so much goodness in him that they're attracted to him and that they show him that he is worthwhile as a human being. When people receive love, and this is what theologians call the redemptive process, that other people are showing this love really in the place of Christ or God, and later on this will lead to a religious point of view for very many people. When they come in contact with Christianity, for instance, they can say, oh yes, I know what it is. The love of Christ for me is just a much more magnified point of view than my father's love for me, or my mother's love for me, or something like this. Let me just briefly restate this again, because I feel like it is badly been unfortunate to make the point I tried to make. Human beings are born in the state of original sin theologically, but psychologically narcissistic, or autoerotic activity, or egocentric, or homosexual. All they really care about is their own individual satisfaction. If a person receives an abundance of love, if mother and father are with him quite often and convey to him that he is worth their attention and their energy because there's something so good about his being, and this has sort of been symbolized, I think, in the Bible by saying man is created in the image of God, that there is good in him, sort of ontological good, using Harold's frame of reference from last week. That if this is conveyed to the person by a lot of attention and love, and a lot of this has to be by physical proximity, tactile stimulation here, and we discussed this some of this today. If this happens at about the time of adolescence, and that's really very seldom before that, the most psychological theorists say at about that time, it will be possible for a person to start to form his own identity as something worthwhile, to form his own sense of goal or value system. There are certain things that I not only would die for, because lots of people have that, to see something that, well, if I were really threatened with this value, otherwise death, maybe I choose death, I'll die for it, I'll be a martyr for these values. But even more difficult, these are values that I will live humbly for in my life. You know, that they'll be the foundation of my existence day by day, they're so important to me. And it is possible in around this time of personality development to develop these kinds of goals and values and strengths that carry you through the... If this happens, and it can only happen by love from other people, then a human being becomes capable of what Freud and his theory calls a heterosexual relationship, where he really has the interest of another human being at heart more than his own homosexual or autoerotic activity, sensual pleasure. Or in the words of Eric Erickson, this leads to a sense of intimacy, where there's a trust relationship, that where you're with another person to fuse your common goals, your common good, in order to then generate for the well-being of society or your family or whatnot. This can happen. Now, why am I saying this in connection with loss? Psychologists have noticed this about human beings, that if a person lives on a level on which he is born, narcissistic, egocentric, in love with himself, homosexual rather than heterosexual. And this is a very common temptation. Now let me, when I talk about homosexual here, I'm not just referring to what we now call a perversion. I think it is a perversion in some sense, but activity between two people of the same sex, for instance. But let me, as long as I started this digression, just let me tell you a story that might make the point better. One of the people that I have been counseling with and have gotten to really love in many ways is a girl who had a lot of problems with sex. She was a girl who came from a family that was way too busy for her. A very wealthy and important family, but always out of the country while she was left alone and in boarding school in various places. And she never received much attention, and she felt quite lonely. When she came to St. Olaf College, one of the ways that she started to deal with this loneliness was by alcohol, sort of her frustrations and reasons when she got drunk. But alcoholic activity, as you might suspect, very quickly led to sexual activity. Somehow this loneliness that she felt couldn't be eased by alcohol, but was in some sense eased by the intimacy that she found with males. But it was a very funny thing, and I noticed this time and time again in this kind of activity. The thrill that she got out of sex, out of heterosexual relationships, was not the thrill of sexual activity, the central thrill at all. This to her was nothing, and she tried to get it over with as quickly as possible in the boys that she met, you know, while she was out drinking and doing these things. But after this, she now had enough of a reputation that she most of the time slept overnight at different apartments or motels or various places in the community. And as soon as intercourse was through with, she then had her delight. It's the kind of a delight that some of you may not be able to understand if you're really, you know, if you've received all this love. But to her was such a thrill. Here was a warm, living, breathing human being in bed next to her asleep that she could just stay awake and watch and be with. This sense of intimacy. Here is a person alive that's sleeping with her. And it's so much nicer than the stuffed animals and the pillows and the blankets that she cuddles at night alone when she can't sleep with anyone. And she really has no care about these people. She really doesn't experience, you see, any real thrill in sex with them, but they have been intimate with her. And now while they are asleep, they're a warm body. And she can stay with them. And this is a closeness that she feels that really gives her something. But not enough. This girl and many, many other people find that this kind of activity isn't enough. And what she has now begun to do, well, a year ago she began this and still hasn't stopped, is decide that what I really need in my life to make me happy is a relationship of somebody that loves me for more than just my body and the sensual thrills that I give them. And so she not only is a homosexual, a lesbian. She and another girl who has the same problem are sleeping together, well, not just sleeping together, but are having sexual activity. And it's not just for the thrills of sex, but because they realize that somehow they're in the same problem, they have something in common, they're somehow relating on a much deeper level, and she gets much more out of it. I'm not trying to, I notice here a couple people in the back there look a little shocked about this. In a way, it is a very shocking thing, and I'm not saying it to start me. What I'm saying is to make my point before I make it. That individual psychology tells us about people. They can never, ever be truly happy, experience the deep happiness that human beings deserve, unless they are able to overcome their own self-centered point of view and be involved in an intimate relationship, not necessarily a sexual one. Two communists working for the good of the Communist Party, and they had this intimacy because of the fusion of their life goals. Or two Catholic priests who are forbidden to marry may have this intimacy in trying together to praise God in working out a parish life or something. It does not have to be sexual. But unless human beings are able to, and I think this is a very, it's symbolic maybe, but I think a very literal truth about the nature of man. When Christ talks about a man first must, I don't quote Bible often enough to memorize this, but it's something about he must die before he's reborn or lose his life before he finds it, isn't that how it goes? There's something very true psychologically about this. Unless a man or woman, a human being, is able to renounce this principle of self-gratification and find something else, a relationship of love, and then a kind of a realization that other human beings are the good to be loved. Unless he does this and becomes more concerned about others than himself, the kind of a life like Albert Schweitzer presumably was able to live, to lose his life and the life of other human beings just because they existed and had need of him. Unless a person's able to do this, he will lose his happiness. He will not be mentally as healthy or as happy as if he can find it. Now, my point of view is this, that the Ten Commandments at least, and many other laws, but at least the Ten Commandments are psychological laws that I don't know how Moses found this out. Maybe it's a revelation from God or what. But somehow, somebody or God or something realized that the nature of human beings is such that if he is going to find ultimate happiness in this life, he's going to live by these rules. The first three commandments say, you must have a commitment to an ultimate good. You don't take the name of your ultimate good or your God in vain. You live with this as a basic source of strength. You are committed to an ultimate good. And you take time out to revere this ultimate good and to dedicate your life to it. And some people call this prayer, some meditation, and some just a time for reflection about what their life is. But all great people seem to take this time. You know, remember, keep holy the Lord's Day kind of thing. They take time out to set their life in perspective. And many people call this prayer. I think that's what this commandment really is talking about. The first three commandments say you must have an ultimate good to which you are attracted. And unfortunately for some, unfortunately for others, we can't do anything about this ourselves. It comes only through love. If we receive love, we become acquainted with the nature of this goodness, and then we can become, you see, attracted to it, and this is our goal, and then it becomes our commitment. The last seven commandments tell us that if we are once acquainted with the nature of ultimate good, which is God, we have absolutely no choice but to recognize this God in other people. And if we do that, we will not kill them, and we will not steal from them, and we will not commit adultery. And part of the reason we don't commit adultery, and this leads back to sex again, is because there are only two, and we talked about this, I think, yesterday, only two behaviors that I know of in this entire world that can be either entirely, 100% selfish, and sex is one of them, like the story of Aladdin's magic lamp. The other one is killing. You can kill, for instance, Abraham could be willing to sacrifice Isaac for the sake of this greater good. These two can be either totally selfish or totally unselfish, but these are the only two I've ever heard of. And sex can be this way. Let me read you a poem now, and this, I think, will make my point. This is a poem. I'm not going to tell you at first who it's written by. But it says, upon my flowering breast, his only, as no man but he might prove, here slumbering did he rest neath my caressing love, fanned by the cedars swaying high above. When from the turret's height scattering his locks, the breezes played around, with touch serene and light, he dealt me love's sweet wound, and with the joyful pain thereof I swooned. Forgetful, rapt I lay, my face replanting on my loved one fair. All things for me that day seized as I slumbered there amid the lilies drowning all my care. Now this sounds very much like an erotic love poem. To me, the imagery here is the same as if I were to write a love poem to my wife. I think this would be a wonderful one in a sense. And it's a very erotic poem. He dealt me love's sweet wound, and with the joyful pain thereof I swooned. Now what's that imagery? It's very obvious, at least to me. He's talking about something very sexual here, or she's talking about something very sexual. And what this is, it's a prayer of the mystic Saint Teresa. She is writing this love poem to Christ. And it's the ultimate expression of her love, of an unselfish adoration for her Savior. And some of you have read some of the mystic writings of this woman. There is no question that for her, her love can be expressed most beautifully and most gloriously in this unselfish activity, which is sexual. That for human beings, sex can be the most ultimate good, I believe, the most ultimate expression of love, because we don't have the equipment to be better than this. The intimate relationship between two people who really love each other can be, I think, a wonderful and a glorious thing. Or it can be an Aladdin and his magic lamp and turn into a very selfish, despicable thing that destroys a relationship between people instead of build it up. Instead of searching for a good in a relationship, it can destroy it. Well, now let me just close with what I would like to say as a summary of this again. Human beings are basically sinful and selfish when they're born. But if they stay this way, they will constantly, forever be unhappy and frustrated. It's terribly frustrating to see yourself as the center of the universe and not see all your needs being met. Even sex for you, if you're selfish, loses its thrill. And I know of people like this and have counseled with them before they finally have gone places otherwise, either in a mental institution or have got out of school and somewhere else, who have been very selfish about this and have seen sex at first as the ultimate in stimulation and providing their thrills. And then it loses this thrill, and they go to something, maybe homosexuality, or maybe drugs, and then alcohol first before drugs. And eventually what they do is destroy themselves physically as well as mentally, because they can't, the thrills just aren't there anymore when a person is self-centered. And I've told some of these case histories, I think, in some of the reading groups or somewhere, and I've been deeper than here. But it's my belief, and then you can attack or discuss as you like. And I'll just say it as my belief without supporting it with these kind of case histories anymore. So let me just do that. I'll state my belief and then I'll be done and we can discuss. Human beings are basically theologically sinful and unclean, psychologically narcissistic and egocentric, homosexual creatures that are concerned only with themselves and their own pleasure. But if they stay that way their entire lives, they're doomed to a life of unhappiness. And if a human being wants to lead an abundant life, a life of joy and of happiness, he must behave in his life very much, in fact, exactly the way that are described by the Ten Commandments. These are rules to tell a person how to be abundantly happy. Select, you know, and this can't be done for you. It has to be done when you receive love. But somehow, you know, theologically, Christ says, I have chosen you, you don't choose me. And psychologically, we say, if you don't receive love from somebody else, you'll never love anybody else or have an ultimate good. But if someone loves you, you will be able to do the first three commandments soon. You'll be able to have an ultimate good that you can be committed to and live for. You know, have a holy God. And it might be the God of Christianity, or it'll be something very much like it. It'll be a God of love. And once that's happened, you will be able to do the last seven commandments. You will be able to love your neighbor because you'll see the image of this goodness in your neighbor. And you'll be able to understand that your true happiness will not be from stealing from him or killing him or having, I think what my definition is, and this maybe is a point that I'll be attacked most of, my definition of adultery is the use of another human being for your own pleasure without being concerned about that person's well-being. You use that person as Aladdin used his magic lamp in order to provide this kind of homosexual thrill for yourself. It's kind of like Hugh Hefner's philosophy. You're still the center of your world and you violate other human beings. And I've talked to so many people who have been violated in this way and seen what happens to them. I think it's just as bad for the violator as the violated. That if you use another human being only for your own selfish pleasure and not because of an attraction to the good in that person, that is adultery. And if you once are clean with the nature of goodness and you see that in other people, you'll no longer do that. And so all of the Ten Commandments you then will keep because it makes you happy to keep them. To the extent that you break any of these Ten Commandments, psychologically you will be less happy. But now I know I should really, I suppose, and I'm not going to do this. My interpretation of these Ten Commandments sometimes differs a little bit from what I've heard in Sunday school classes. But it's almost been necessary for me to do this from what I know of psychology. But I do firmly believe, 100%, that with the proper understanding of what these commandments mean and relating it to psychology, that this is the most tried and true way of ultimate happiness that man knows. And that's why laws are here. That's why the Ten Commandments are here. For the individual good of the psychology of the individual. Luckily, it works out that way that if the individual becomes fulfilled in this way, the society also will. And if a man lives for other people, the whole society is going to benefit a lot more than if he lives for himself. And then the political and economic and social well-being of the community are also met. But first and foremost, laws, especially the Ten Commandments, are put here for our own good individually. And only if we're going to be happy, we can't help but obey these laws. Even though, and let me tell you one other example. I know of at least one case where people, let's say, are having intercourse before they're married, at least if we count marriage as going through the ceremony performed by a minister. And yet I believe that these people are not committing adultery and that they really are finding happiness, but they're not violating each other out of love. They're very deeply in love with each other. And for reasons of, you know, they've been conditioned somewhat, they believe themselves in a way married. Well, let's not believe that. We need to do that as people object to that question. And let me close that. That's my own personal belief about why laws are here. It's for the individual happiness of the human being. Especially, I'm not going to talk about the remains of laws that society now has, but especially the basic Ten Commandments on which the Judeo-Christian tradition is, well, it's still very much alive today. So anybody that has any point of reputation or any questions, it is free to take the floor. I have spoken my opening piece.
In the Old Testament, it says an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, and so on. Why the change, then, if people are to find love in Old Testament law, why the change in the New Testament when Christ says, but I say unto you, turn the other cheek, and so on?
Does anybody else want to respond to this? I'd be glad to, but I don't want to just monopolize the conversation. I know there's a lot of people here that are more theological than I am. If anybody else like to respond to that, if they don't, I will, but I've just seen somebody else do. Anybody? Paul, you want to say something about that? Well, what I think is that the New Testament really is a fulfillment of the law of man, the natural way that man is, and it's a law of love. And that perfect love, really, as opposed to the kind of love that man is sort of born with. You see, I think theologically and psychologically here, we could get into a discourse about Christ being the really redemption for man to really show him true love. You see, offering his life for man shows him a real definite commitment of love. You know, if I give my life for you, that's proof that I love you. That when Christ came, what he really came to do is show man a much more perfect love, one that he could identify with both as humanity and as perfect God. And that this kind of love casts out hatred and casts out revenge and casts out... Not only that, but there's something else, and St. Paul's really kind of cute here when he talks about this. He says, love your neighbor because if you show him... I mean, love your enemy. Because if you love your enemy, what it does is it keeps burning coals on his head, you know, and it'll be much worse for him than if you try to revenge him. I think that's very true, that I've noticed myself, punishment of transgressions or of sins or of breaking of the law doesn't really seem to make a heck of a lot of difference to people. If they do something they think is wrong, and they're showing love anyhow, their conscience or their own selves punishes them so much. They become mentally ill very often because they feel so unworthy of this love at the beginning. They'd much rather have punishment as a burning coal on their head. Much more than punishment often, even though oftentimes it's also the kind of thing that makes them snap themselves, you know, into more of an appropriate kind of behavior. But I think when Christ is talking about, you know, don't have an eye for an eye or a tooth for a tooth, he's saying it won't do you any good. It'll do you a lot much better if you can instead love these people. But also for that person, it isn't really going to do any good either. That perfect love is going to be more of a if you want to look at it, more of a revenge at first, or also more of a redemptive process for that person than revenge would. Because once you revenge yourself on him, that makes it even. And there's no reason for him to change anymore. He, you know, your score is settled. But if he's in debt to you now, and you love him anyhow, there's a real incongruence, or a real, what we call, cognitive dissonance about his behavior there. It's real upsetting to people. And I think sometimes this upsetting nature makes them change their own behavior.
Can I have a chance to answer it now?
The law says what men ought to be, and it has their good at heart. In that sense, the law is good. But the law is incapable of turning people into what they ought to be. You know, be loving, damn you! You know, it doesn't work. Now, the law, therefore, is a social thing. What the law does not make people good, or what they ought to be, or happy. But the law preserves the possibility within society of people becoming what they ought to be. Thus, the law prevents some of the grossest forms of disruption of society, which would make it almost impossible for anybody to go through the stages and become what he ought to be.
If there were perfect love in society, there'd be no need
for
law.
Right. And now what Jesus is saying, he's fulfilling the law. He's pointing out what the real purpose of the law was, which is not just to fence people about so that those who somehow or the other have a chance can actualize themselves. But Jesus is saying, I want to talk to you. I want to bring to you that power which is capable of transforming men. Therefore, it's not enough to say an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. That's just the preliminary thing. That's what is unfortunately socially necessary. But there is something beyond that. You must turn the other cheek. But Jesus goes on. He just doesn't announce the new law. Thou shalt turn the other cheek, or I'll clobber it. He says, I'm going to show you how this can be done. Well, Jesus comes to bring the power to fulfill the law. In that sense, he is the fulfillment of the law.
So, yeah, let me just quickly apologize to people. I thought we had 15 minutes left, but I wouldn't have talked so long.
It's only 10 o'clock.
Mm-hmm. It's 10 o'clock. We've got to go around at 15.
Will you go over there, Carol, make sure there's some food?
I hope that doesn't cut everybody off now.
I think, though, the problems that you put it up in this freedom area are the ones that really possess me at this moment. I mean, we got a wonderful letter from this group here last week, you know, and it's all guilt. You know, this place exists to free people from guilt, not impose it on. But when we have these kids in who only operated under the strictures that adolescence usually gets, you know, and still walking with the canes or the family regulations and the church rules, and suddenly they're exposed here to the only kind of discipline, which is that of a community in freedom. And they can't respond to it. I mean, they responded to it by almost total withdrawal as one particular group. Now that they're gone from it, they're weeping and lamenting, you know, and they write back a letter that's, you know, solid with their tears. And gee, what we want to do is free from guilt, not impose it. That very freedom that you're speaking of for those who are not ready for it can evidently be a vicious thing. I mean, so evidently there is a meaning even in training the race in that Old Testament law, is what I'm getting at, and maybe we need some kinds of understanding of how we grow under law until we can be free from it. What we know in our own individual experiences seems to be necessary also collectively.
Would anyone like to comment then about what we've talked about? Is I made the thesis statement that the Ten Commandment laws exist for the happiness of society. I know there are people here who believe differently, and I wish you'd respond. I've talked with people who have said that this is really harmful for human beings. For instance, to be constrained, let's say, in sexual activity, because this seems to be the real focus of humanity, what they do sexually. You know, whether you're selfish or unselfish in this area seems to determine your life in many other areas. And they say if we restrict this and say thou shalt not commit adultery, that means you can restrict yourself really only to one mate in marriage. And that's pretty much what it means, all right. This is a very stifling kind of a thing. You can't love other people. Doesn't anyone want to respond in this way and find out why, who's right and why? You know, why would it be if human beings are made to be ultimately happy living under these laws, that a person would be constrained to one mate and committed to that one mate publicly? Why would this be important, or wouldn't it be? would it be just as easy to have a love relationship, I mean a sexual relationship, unknown to anyone else and with several other people? You know, where there's no then public commitment needed. Why wouldn't this be fulfilled?
Are you speaking of our society though?
No, right. I'm speaking of everyone.
What about societies that accept and condone?
What about them? That's a good question. What about them? Take, for instance, everybody proud. How many people have you seen the movie Hawaii? Well, I thought maybe more of you would have. In that movie, it shows just what you're talking about that exists apparently in the Caribbean Islands and in New Guinea and in South American tribes. When the first missionaries came to Hawaii, there were naked women that swam out to the boats to have intercourse with these people as a sign of joyous welcome. What's wrong? I mean, isn't that a very happy society? When this happens. Is there anything else other than sharks? So why wouldn't this be a joyous, wonderful, much more happy way to live than the way we live right now in this society? Or is it? That's what I'm asking. See, my thesis is, you know, and I'll defend it eventually, is that we are more happy if we make a public commitment sexually to one person instead of have what we call free love. This is my thesis, that psychologically a person is happier despite his culture.
The Ten Commandments destroyed his children and islanders.
Well, there's no question about that. What really seemed, it wasn't the Ten Commandments, it seemed like the American tourist once they found out what was happening. Everybody went over there to get in on the... But why would our society allow? Now I'm not saying this. Look, there's two things that are possible. I am not saying that people in our society are more happy than people in these primitive tribes, because it's obvious we right now, most of us are not. What I am saying is that for a person to be most ideally happy psychologically, he would, I mean, the perfectly really happy human being would end up living like the Ten Commandments say, rather than like the Trobriand Islands. That's what I'm saying. That those people who really are fulfilled, living an abundant life psychologically and spiritually, these people, despite their culture, would end up living as our Ten Commandments dictate rather than the Trobriand Islands. Even though I know the way it is right now, many people in our society are terribly unhappy. But what I'm saying then is that's because they're living by the law and not by the spirit of, you know, what's good. They don't ever receive the love, they just have to conform to these dolls without ever getting it. Well, I didn't mean to cut things off right here, but what would be happier? Why would it be happier to be in the Trobriand Islands than here, assuming that Americans hadn't taken over the Trobriand Islands already? Or say Hawaii 100 years ago or 200 years ago. Why would a person be more happy living that way? In a free-flowing communal atmosphere where sex with anyone attractive to you is perfectly acceptable. Not in violence, there are not rapes going on, but among consenting peoples. Why would this be a happy way to live than the way we live right now?
Is that really, does being a smorgasbord sexually, does this really create the, is it possible to create really a relationship? A one-to-one relationship where a mutual trust of this kind of kind of thing that would be developed through knowing a person in both.
Where's Julie? Is she here?
No, she's not. My Julie?
Yeah. She talked about a community. Maybe, Paul, you have read the same things and could respond to this. She, yesterday, I think it was, she talked about a community of people who are living, and it's called a Lynch family. It's not really a family biologically or genetically, but it's a community that has come together and share sexual relationships with each other and raise the children in a communal atmosphere. Now, the question is, are these people living in a relationship of trust? I mean, I think there are people that would definitely say yes. But it can be, at least in a small community like this, 10 people or more, I don't know just how large it is, that these people, why not? Why couldn't they?
I don't know. It seems to me that you can know one person to a greater depth than you can 15 contacts or 20 contacts. I don't know. It just seems that this would be more of a possibility. With knowing 15 people on a some kind of schedule, I suppose. I don't know how they work this out. knowing people in this way, is there really any possibility of knowing somebody beyond this?
Well, let's talk about it the opposite way, because this is a very real situation. When a person confines himself in commitment to one mate, aren't there other people that are equally attractive to him? I mean, let's say here I am at Holden Village with my wife, and there's all kinds of pretty girls around. I mean, isn't this very confining for me to be restricted to my wife sexually instead of being able to enjoy this relationship, this very intimate relationship with many of these very, you know... well, she's not in this room, I don't think, but she's here. No. Isn't that very confining for me? Wouldn't it be better for me if I were able to exercise this freedom of my attractions?
I think the problem depends on what level you want to operate on.
Why?
Whether you're operating on purely a sexual level. If this is knowing a person in the pure sense of sex, then yeah, it's really restricted. You know. But if there's something to knowing a person, if the person goes deeper than merely the sexual part, if there is more to a person, being, then I don't think it's really not restricted.
Why is it better to know one person in depth than to know 15 in lesser depth? I mean, you might get more total depth.
Maybe it's selfish. maybe it's selfish, but I think that when you know a person in depth, you also know yourself.
Let me respond to this, just because I sort of felt compelled to do this. You know, even if I shut everybody else up. I think it leads back, this is my belief again, and sometimes I do state my belief quite strongly, even though it sometimes shuts up other people who just because I've been so strong. That I think there's something very, very real about a commitment involved in a relationship when there's a sincere love. That it's the kind of a thing that in many ways is the most unselfish. Where when a person really loves another human being in this kind of depth we're talking about, it really makes him in many ways, it's like suffering in a very real sense in the strengthening way. That suffering for a person can make him really strong because it helps him lose his life for something else, give up the selfish nature that he's born with and experience something else. And in our book discussion this afternoon, we're going to talk about this in the nature of suffering, but there's something about commitment that does the same. If my wife knows that I am totally committed to her welfare because of our intimate relationship, it means that when she's in trouble or in need or has children that are in need, that she can count on me to sort of give up some of myself because of our love and our commitment for her, and provides a much better life for her than if I had 15 wives and three of them at the same time needed me in a very special way. I'd have to choose among the three. And this is very often, I know it from St. Olaf College, it's a very common situation that there are many people at the same time who need desperate help. And then you have to choose, but if you have this total commitment because you say in this person and in this relationship, we both sort of, you know, there's a good here that is above and beyond both of us to which we're committed, but the good comes really because of our commitment in love, that it seems somehow to provide something much more satisfying to each of us. I know I can count on her and she knows she can count on me. And there's something much more special about this than if someone else were, you see, at times to take my attention.
This is what I meant by death, I think.
I know Harold's going to...
I didn't do that, Nick. Of course, there's a big difference between one man and 15 wives, and 15 men and 15 women. And, well, if two people, you know, relate to each other and have a kind of in-depth relationship, to the exclusion of others, of course, the relationship is going to be very strange and for very little. It's not going to be an in-depth relationship with
That's a good point. What I'm saying is that this kind of deep relationship provides a strength. You know, it's like Eric Erickson's theory that intimacy comes before generativity. That when two people really love in this depth, what happens is it provides a strength to be able to give to the wider community. You see, generativity follows, not precedes, intimacy.
Sure, I would agree with that completely.
And so it just seemed to me that it followed it. They wrote out of intimacy would allow for, you know, very deep love relationships with many people, and that this would be entirely desirable for all of us.
But would he be sexual?
Yes, because he has sexual
needs. Sure, I mean, I think...
You know why? You know why I disagree with that? Because I say they would be sexual, not because of anything good, but because of the selfish nature of us. Well, now what happens is, you see something that...
In a situation where you have 15 people living together and they said, you know, haven't got grown into this generative stage.
Right.
You see, but right. And that would be very bad. You know, that would be adultery or promiscuity or something. But, and I wonder if it's possible for us to make this kind of growth given the cultural context that we're in.
I would say yes.
For most of us, it's not. Not possible
to make this kind of well, that's what I agree with. But I'd say even in every culture, that what happens is that, and I think that in a sense this is bad, but in another sense it's good, that if we really love some other person, this is my real belief, what we say is there is so much goodness in you that I'm attracted to, that this goodness somehow, my attraction to this goodness is very important, and it does something for that other person to know that I'm attracted to the goodness in her. You know, to commit myself to
something
her.
Bad for her, she thinks that you're the only person that sees any goodness in her.
Yes.
And that you're, you know, actually.
But what I am also saying
in order to, you know, construct
is that if I can also see goodness in other people. And I, you know, in my own practice, I do this. There are, you know, a lot of co-eds, for instance, that I'll, you know, tell the secretary, no calls into my office now. I'm busy. My wife calls. And the secretary doesn't put it through. You know, and here I am spending much of my time and reading much of my love on this other, you know, sometimes very attractive girl. And that's there. But at the point at which I say, my attraction for this girl is not only love, but it's, you know, it's a different kind of love. It's sexual. And I want to have intercourse with this girl that I'm counseling. Then I think what I've really done is violated something in me, and I've been selfish instead of unselfish. That I'm much more unselfish to give of my attention to this girl in ways that are other than sexual, than are sexual. That if I were to be sexual with her, I would be hurting her and me in a way that wouldn't be right, and also hurting my wife. That to be totally unselfish, I would have to be unsexual with these other women. Because if I were sexual with them, my wife would feel much less good with her.
If that's a different situation, then it would be, you know, you would have to be involved in
this. How would your wife feel yourself if you're unselfish?
I think that once I become sexual with other women, she sort of feels I'm selfish. And I think I would be. I think this is, I know it's easy to rationalize, and I think that's what it is. Our basic nature, being selfish, being Aladdin in his magic lamp and wanting our own physical, sensual thrills instead of something different. And I think...
Why?
You're being selfish toward her, if you think it's being selfish. Or at least she's being very selfish toward you.
Well, there's a sense in this commitment, I think, that you could call in a way selfish, because what we're doing is excluding this sexual relationship from other people. But I've noticed in the nature of people that have talked... Well, go ahead.
Why do you equate sexuality with intercourse? You did that.
Well, I think often it's sexuality.
Right. Because I think we've gotten so messed up because we think sexuality has limitations, and it cannot. Because if that sexuality makes us a total human being.
Yeah, you sound just like Freud. He said the same thing. Yeah, he does.
Well, okay. I don't care what you think.
Yeah. Well, there's a real truth in it.
But I think we too compartmentalize ourselves, you know, and said sexuality is for this. But it can't be if we are ourselves wherever we are. And so you can have a sexual, it's got to be sexual when you're with a person because they are two sexual beings. But that doesn't mean, you know, you go to bed with somebody, because you're in a sexual relationship. You see what I mean? I think it's the use of the word sexual that bugs me.
Well, I've sort of done this on purpose, too, because I believe differently than Freud on this point. See,
yeah.
Freud,
how so?
Well, what I think is that what I'm calling here as sexual is anything that, I suppose I have to be real careful how I define it now. Anything that I'm talking about here as sexual is something that points a person towards intercourse in his thoughts and in his behavior. And I think that, I think there's a very real way in which we can limit sexuality to this.
Is there any, yeah, I do too, I agree with that, but is there any word that we can use that...
Love.
That's something more than that, because that...
Love.
There is something more.
Love. I think, really, I'm not being joking, I'm very serious about this. I think love is the word you're looking for.
No.
Why not? Even though I think really and truly too, there's a very special way in which the most ultimate communication of love for human beings will be intercourse.
Yeah. All I'm trying to say is, you approach a person as an object and a sexual being. As a woman,
I'm not as a real problem. In a sense, what you're really asking though. Yeah, I think though, in a sense, what you're really asking is a problem that many people do ask. Is there any real difference, and if so, what, between love and sex?
No, I'm not.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, what would the difference be in your mind then? If you tell me that difference, I think I won't have the same problem with what you said as I do now.
Between love and sex?
Right. You say you're a sexual being in your relation to every other person because they're sexual, right?
Yeah.
Okay, now what's the difference between love and sex then for you?
Well, what do you mean by sex?
Well, what do you mean? That's what I'm asking. See, I have this figured out in my own head with my own relationship. Well, if you just explain to me your difference, what you mean by love and what you mean by sex, then I won't have any problem with what you said.
Sex
I have
or sexuality?
Either. Both.
I'm not very sexy, but I'm sexual. And that's the kind of difference
I'm
trying to make.
Well, see, that's the problem I'm having, is understanding the difference.
All right,
I'm sorry. See, if I really understood what you meant and the difference between these two words, I feel you might communicate.
Okay, I don't want to love somebody as... I don't want to love somebody as...
Thank you.